This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Obadiah. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in Obadiah with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
One commentator said of Edom's attitude toward his northern neighbor Israel, "The only thing about Edom that bordered on religious fervor was their concentrated, persistent, bitter hatred against the Hebrews." Reminds us of the Palestinian hatred against the Jews that exists today. Remember when Israel came out of Egypt and headed for the Promised Land, it was Edom who refused to allow Moses to pass through their borders. That antagonism was there. Throughout their history, Edom was an antagonist toward Israel, was an enemy. King Saul, David, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Amaziah, Ahaz, Zedekiah, they all waged war against Edom. The conflict with Edom was constant, always under the surface. This was a long-running family feud. In fact, you and I can't even celebrate Christmas without reliving the friction between Esau and Jacob, Edom and Israel. Jesus, the newborn king of Israel, was born in Bethlehem. You know that. The king in Jerusalem at the time was a man named Herod. And when the wise men asked about this new king's birth, Herod realized that there was a rival. He became jealous. And to try to stamp out his rival, you remember, he ordered the execution of all the male babies under 2 years old in Bethlehem. Herod claimed to be king of the Jews. That's why he was infuriated when the wise men came seeking the king of the Jews. Herod claimed to be king of the Jews, but he wasn't really a Jew. He was a convert to Judaism. Guess what his birth certificate read? Edomite. King Herod was Esau, part of Esau's bitter bloodline. The family feud addressed in Obadiah becomes a backdrop for the first Christmas. Yet verse 11 refers to another episode in this feud. "In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." Whenever another nation would invade Jerusalem, Edom was always quick to pile on, to sort of take advantage of Jerusalem's distress. Though Obadiah doesn't provide a historical context here, he definitely has a particular incident in mind, no doubt. Here's one of the problems we have with the study of Obadiah. There are actually a dozen Obadiahs in the Old Testament. We're not sure which one this Obadiah was or when he served. Depending on the date, there are several possibilities for when foreigners enter Jerusalem and for the situation that's referred to here. Some scholars place this in the middle of the 9th century B.C., Edom rebelled against King Jehoram, and Jerusalem was attacked by the Philistines and the Arabians. It could be that Edom joined them at that time. Other scholars lean toward Babylon's invasion of Judah, which occurred much later in 586 BC. We know that when Babylon conquered Jerusalem, Edom rejoiced. There's a psalm, Psalm 137, verse 7, that records their reaction. It says, "Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raz it to its very foundation." In other words, the Edomites became Babylonian cheerleaders. The walls of Jerusalem had been toppled. The temple had been burned. His brother Jacob, the Jews, were reeling. They were about to be taken into captivity. Yet Edom stood on the sidelines and egged on the Babylonians. They cried out for more and more carnage. They wanted to run up the score, in essence, pour it on. They seethed with bitterness. There is a verse, it's found in the Apocrypha, in a book called 1 Esdras 4, verse 45. Now understand what the Apocrypha is. It is not inspired scripture, but it is some interesting history, some stories as well. And 1 Esdras was written just after the fall of Babylon to the Persians. The Jews were about to enter into their 70-year captivity. They would spend their time there in Babylon and they would return home. And that's when a Jew named Zerubbabel, you remember Zerubbabel? We've talked about Zerubbabel. He reminds the king of Persia, and this is what's written in 1 Esdras. You also vowed to build the temple, which the Edomites burned when Judea was laid waste by the Chaldeans. Notice what Zerubbabel says. That Edom helped the Babylonians set fire to God's temple when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem. It just shows the intensity of Edom's hatred for the Jews in Jerusalem. Well, next, Obadiah, he peppers the Edomites with a series of should nots. He tells them, you should not. Verse 12. But you should not have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity. Nor should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. You should not have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Indeed, you should not have gazed on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. In other words, they had entered the city like scavengers to pick through their brother's remaining belongings before the Babylonians took them back to captivity, back to Babel. Edomites were predators. They were scavengers. You should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who escaped, nor should you have delivered up those among them who remained in the day of distress. These Edomites even patrolled the caravan routes leading south out of Jerusalem for Egypt to arrest any of the Jews who might try to escape. When Judah was at its lowest point, the city had been destroyed. Jerusalem had been destroyed. When Judah was at its lowest point, his own brother Esau kicked him in the ribs. See, Edom's sin was rubbing it in. They took pleasure in their brother's distress and calamity. In demise. They enjoyed seeing the Jews squirm and sweat and suffer. Edom did nothing to help the Jews, but applauded that they were led away in chains. And here's a word to all you Georgia Tech fans who happen to still be relishing beating the Bulldogs this past year. Beware of the sin of rubbing it in. Don't be Edomites. And rejoice in your foe's demise. I once had a supervisor, his name was Ralph. We worked together at the DuPont Distribution Center over in Dorval. One Friday afternoon, I was locking up. We were at the end of a long week. We were wrapping it up and heading home. I parked the forklift and gotten everything ready, locked the door. And when I went out on the dock, I found an old hobo, a homeless man. He'd come in on a railroad car, and he was lying in a drunken stupor on our warehouse dock. Now, according to company policy, Ralph should have run the fellow off the property. Instead, at Ralph's suggestion, I went back into the warehouse. I got some of the foam packing material we used to ship product, and I brought it out there, and I set him up a little bed made out of packing material on the loading dock. Ralph told me to go in and get him a soda out of the machine and a pack of crackers. We laid them there next to the foam mat so the guy would have something to eat when he woke up. And I'll never forget what Ralph told me before we left that afternoon. He said, Sandy, never kick a man when he's down. You never know when you might be that man. You see, Edom should have had mercy on his fallen brother. But instead, the nation poured salt on the wound, kicked Judah while he was down. Seven times in three verses, verses 12 through 14, God says to Edom, you should not have. God was angry at Edom for the cruelty that he had showed Judah and would punish them as a result. Verse 15, for the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. Here's God's message to Edom. What goes around comes around. Beware, be careful. Since Edom kicked Israel, Edom will also get the boot. History tells us this happened. Babylon eventually turned on the Edomites. In addition 200 years later, around 300 BC, we're now between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Edom was conquered by the Greek army and their great general, Alexander the Great. Eventually, the Jews gained their independence from the Greeks. That's when Israel and their Maccabean kings conquered and scattered the Edomites among the surrounding nations. And by the 3rd century AD, Edom was spoken of as a people who no longer existed. As verse 16 tells us, "For as you drank on my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. Yes, they shall drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been." By the time Edom kicked a downtrodden Israel onward, they became a nation small and despised, just as Obadiah had predicted. You will be a people as if they never existed. But Obadiah's prophecy isn't over. For not only does he predict God's judgment on the Edomites, what about the target of Esau's hatred and resentment? Israel was the victim of Edom's antagonism. And the last verses of Obadiah are God's promise to bless and to deliver the Jews. Edom's hidden treasures will be ripped off, but the Hebrews' treasures will be recovered and restored. I love verse 17. To me, it is one of the most provocative verses in all of the Bible. Obadiah says, "On Mount Zion, there shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions." Think about that phrase for a minute. Possess their possessions. What does it mean to possess your possessions? It would seem to me, if something was your possession, wouldn't you already possess it? Not necessarily. William Randolph Hearst was a wealthy tycoon. He made his money in the newspaper business. He was also an avid art collector. A number of years ago, Kathy and I visited his castle and saw some of his collection. Well, one day, Hearst was thumbing through a magazine, and he saw this beautiful painting. He called in an assistant, and he made this assistant's mission to go out and to find and to purchase this painting. Well, after combing galleries all around the world, he returned to report the results of a failed mission. Hearst got angry. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He sent him out again, and he told him not to come back without this coveted addition to his collection. Well, finally, the painting was located in one of Hearst's own warehouses. You see, William Randolph Hearst had owned the painting the whole time, but he had failed to possess his possessions. And there are followers of Jesus, I'm afraid, who are in the exact same boat. Hey, all that you need, Jesus has already provided. Ephesians 1 verse 3 tells us, "By his death on the cross, our Lord Jesus has purchased for us all spiritual blessings." Sitting in God's warehouse right now is unlimited power, an unquenchable love, an inexpressible joy, an unexplainable peace, an otherworldly wisdom. And your name is on exactly all that you need. It was purchased with you in mind. All you have to do now is to snatch it off the shelf. But have you? Have you grabbed it up? Is it your actual possession? And if not, then why not? See, faith is the tentacle. Faith is the suction cup that takes hold of those spiritual blessings. Faith makes the spiritual tangible. It makes the heavenly touchable. It makes the eternal timely. Don't be content just to come to church, just to sing about and read about and talk about the advantages of the Christian life. If you believe it's true, then possess your possessions. Rise up in faith and seize what God has for you. Treat the gifts and the fruits and the graces of His Spirit as if they were your own personal possessions, because they are. Why do you allow the skepticism of others or your own feelings of unworthiness, or maybe even demonic doubts, rob you of enjoying what the blood of Jesus has purchased for you. It's time for all of us to possess our possessions. Well, the rest of Obadiah describes how Judah will burn brightly while Edom will flame out. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them, and no survivor shall remain of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. There's an interesting prophecy in Isaiah chapter 16 concerning the city of Petra, which was the capital of the Edomites. In the last days, prior to Jesus' second coming, outcasts from Judah will flee from the Antichrist into the wilderness, and they'll take refuge there in the caves and in the shelters of Petra. What's ironic about that is that in the midst of God's final judgments, the cliffs and the caves that the Edomites once trusted in to save them but didn't will be used by their rivals, the Jews, as a place of safety. In the end, the nation of Edom will be no more, but Israel, the people of God, will govern God's land. And in verse 19, he explains how Israel will rule over what was once the jurisdiction of Edom. He says, "The south shall possess the mountains of Esau, and the lowland shall possess Philistia. They shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria. Benjamin shall possess Gilead," or the land east of the Jordan River. "And the captains of this host of the children of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. The captives of Jerusalem who are in Shepherad," or you see it there, "shall possess the cities of the south." Verse 21 applies to the judgment of the nations prior to the coming of Jesus in the kingdom age. It says, "Then saviors," that is judges, "shall come to Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's." Judges will come to judge the Edomites. But notice that last line again. "The kingdom shall be the Lord's." In the end, who wins this family feud? Well, you might assume it was Israel, but not really. It's God who wins. And since Israel was aligned with God, Israel shared in God's victory. See, Edom learned the hard way what's true in every conflict. Neither you nor I are on the winning side. Victory belongs to the Lord. See, the question is never, is God on your side? The question is always, are you and I on God's side? That's the question. When you think about Esau and Jacob, their long-running feud, it's amazing how what starts out as a fuss between two brothers over a bowl of stew boils over into the slaughter of all Bethlehem's male babies and eventually into the survival and fall of two nations. Isn't that amazing? You know, they say the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys started when McCoy's hog wandered over into Hatfield land. Hatfield laid claim to it, but McCoy said it was his. The family conflict started to escalate. It took 13 years and 12 killings before both families called for a ceasefire. See, sadly, family feuds, no matter how small, can intensify. They can spill over. They can grow and inflame. They can compound. They can intensify. Perhaps you've been feuding with a brother, or maybe a sister, or a parent, or a child. In recent days, it's escalated. It could be hostility between you and your spouse. Harmony has degenerated into rivalry. Maybe you're in a border war with a neighbor or with a coworker. See, even churches aren't immune from these tribal wars. People get upset with people. They break community. They go across the street and start the second church. We've seen that happen over and over. Christians can stop fellowshipping and start feuding. In all relationships, a simmering hostility can boil over. And here is the thought that I want to leave you with tonight. It is the big idea in Obadiah. We will annoy each other. We will be inconsiderate at times. We'll have our misunderstandings. We'll slight each other. We'll engage in squabbles. We'll have our differences. But simple stuff, like a bowl of chili, turns into a major breach in family feuds for one reason: pride. Pride. When one person won't give in, when one person won't say they're sorry, when one person won't admit their fault of the issue. You know, I've done marriage counseling for years and years and years, and I've never had a situation where it was all one person's fault. Takes two to tango. And it's pride that divides. It's when I'm going to hold my ground and dig in my heels and refuse to admit my part of the problem. Pride is what divides. It causes little fissures that turn into huge chasms. Obadiah promised Edom, if he insisted on thinking he was big stuff, God would make him small. He'll be big, all right, a big whoop-de-doo. That's what he'll become. He'll end up despised, not esteemed. And God will do the same to any of us who hold on to our pride. That's why we need to humble ourselves. We need to be a people known for our humility. We need to stop focusing on how we've been wronged and realize what we've done wrong. We need to deal with our own sin. God will right the wrongs that need to be righted if we'll get our own heart right. Today, do you need to swallow your pride? Is there a friend or a family member or a coworker to whom you need to apologize and make amends? Remember the old adage, you never get heartburn eating humble pie. Don't ever forget what comes after pride. A fall. Pride sets you up for a humble tumble. Proverbs 16, verse 18 says it best. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Just ask the Edomites. I like this quote. A man who acts too big for his britches will be exposed in the end. Jesus said it in Matthew 23, verse 12, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. In 1971, the big fight of the century took place in New York's Madison Square Garden. Muhammad Ali squared off with the champ at the time, jolting, smoking Joe Frazier. Life magazine quoted the boast that Ali made prior to the fight. He said, we're going to decide once and for all who is the king. There's not a man alive who can whoop me. I'm too smart. I'm too pretty. I'm the greatest. I'm the king. I should be a postage stamp. That's the only way I could get licked. But that night, Ali did get licked. Frazier KO'd him. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12 rang true. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. See, here's the problem with pride. Pride puts you first. First in your family. First in your marriage. First at your work. First at your church. First in life. First with your friends. First before God. That's where pride leads. And when you put anything first before God, that's called worship. God hates pride. Because he wants your worship. It's time for some of us to renounce our pride, to bow our knee to God, to acknowledge how much we need him. He doesn't need us. We need to call on Jesus and by faith possess our possessions. But remember, pride is the great divider. Trust Jesus. And he'll end the feud between you and that other person and the feud between you and him.
Thank you for listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. We're currently in a series about the minor prophets, men chosen by God to deliver messages to his people. Their messages of future events must have sounded pretty strange to whoever was listening. It'd be like seeing a rainbow before a storm. Hard to believe, right? Yet the words of these men were God's truth, changing the course of action for anyone who repented and believed. Any spiritual wrestling match we engage in with Jesus will undoubtedly stretch and grow us. Our time together is drawing to a close, but before we go, we want to draw your attention to a few details. Sandy Adams Radio is an outreach ministry of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Visit sandyadams.org to learn more about us. Wherever your day takes you, bring us along by downloading our mobile app. Look for links at sandyadams.org. While you're there, be sure to take note of our service times, because we'd love to have you come join us for a time of worship and fellowship. If you enjoyed today's message, would you let us know? You can contact us by calling 770-736-2828. That number again to call is 770-736-2828. Thanks so much for listening to Sandy Adams Radio.